The final feature of our program is a panel discussion held at the 2006 Miami Breast Cancer Conference, in which community-based medical oncologists Dr. Bill Harwin, Dr. Dennis Lowenthal, and Dr. Atif Hussain presented de-identified cases from their practices to faculty members Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy, Dr. George Sledge, and Dr. Eric Weiner. The theme of this symposium was monoclonal antibody therapy of breast cancer. And to begin, Dr. Lowenthal presented a patient with biopsy-proven recurrence in the sternum.
In April of 2002, this then 46-year-old female who had previously undergone a oophorectomy and hysterectomy for benign disease underwent a left lumpectomy and axillary node dissection for what proved to be a 4.5 centimeter node-negative aneuploid medullary carcinoma of the breast, with ER, PR, HER2, all negative. She received subsequently six cycles of CAF and radiation therapy and did well until September of 2005, when she experienced induration in the left parasternal area. A needle biopsy of that area was now positive for recurrent disease, still ER, PR, HER2 negative. A surveillance PET scan and CAT scan at that time showed moderate mediastinal lymphadenopathy as well as a left parasternal mass.
Dennis, about this woman, what was her lifestyle like and what was her general physical condition at that point when she was diagnosed with metastatic disease?
Fully active, fully employed as an insurance company employee, three children, working mom, very active, otherwise in very good health.
What was her emotional and personal reaction? She's been through CAF chemotherapy and now she's finding out that it didn't work. How did she react to that, and how did that compare to other patients in a similar situation?
Difficult, needless to say. Devastating. The thought of a recurrence was something that had not been foremost on her mind. She had thought her original therapy would likely be curative in nature, as many of our patients do, and quite disappointed, quite devastated.
Now, one of the things that I'm sure the faculty want to know that every oncologist looks at in metastatic disease is whether the tumor is causing symptoms. She has disease in some areas that you get pretty worried about. Do you think she was having symptoms from the tumor?
I do. That discomfort, that parasternal discomfort, it was, Neil, right in the area of her radiation port, so there was some question of whether or not this was just delayed radiation toxicity, but ultimately we did the biopsy and proved her recurrence.
I see. Okay, so we've got that one out on the table, and we want Bill to present his patient, and then we'll kind of talk about management of metastatic disease and how these two patients fit into the current paradigm. Bill?
Okay, this is a 51-year-old woman who at the age of 45 underwent a right modified radical mastectomy for two separate primary tumors that totaled 3.3 centimeters, highly estrogen and progesterone receptor positive with four positive axillary lymph nodes. She was treated with adjuvant chemotherapy with four cycles of Adriamycin Cytoxan and four cycles of Taxotere and started tamoxifen in late 2000. She was a patient that had a hysterectomy but not an oophorectomy. In April 2005, she developed rising CA2729 and abnormal liver function tests, and her CT scan showed multiple liver metastases, the largest in the 6 to 7 centimeter range. She underwent a biopsy which confirmed metastatic breast cancer, ER positive, HER2 new negative.
So now both of these patients are HER2 new negative, so we're not going to really get into the issue of Herceptin and the metastatic setting. But one is a triple negative, so she's ER and PR negative also, and the other is ER and PR positive. And again, Bill, can you talk a little bit about what the woman's lifestyle was like and her general physical condition?
She was in good physical condition. She had one unusual thing is that she had a congenital deformity where she was almost equivalent to above-the-elbow amputation on one arm. But she worked in the computer business and was a former hospital administrator.
And what was her reaction? Again, here's another patient who's been through some pretty difficult adjuvant chemotherapy only to find that she has liver mets.
Well, she was pretty taken aback, but she was well-adjusted emotionally to this setback.
Before we start getting into the specifics, maybe we can just chat for a little bit about dealing with the patient, the person who's confronting metastatic disease. George, you and your partner at IU, Kathy Miller, have written and talked a lot about how you set goals for patients in the metastatic setting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, when learned professors get up and front of audiences to talk about how they take care of patients, they tend to ignore what every clinician knows, which is with breast cancer patients, everything you do with the patient involves a series of negotiations between the physician and the patient. And one thing I always tell my patients, actually I stole this from Cliff Huddis at Memorial, is that whenever you have a doctor and a patient in the room, you have two experts in the room. You have an expert on the disease and you have an expert on the patient. And those two experts need to agree before you go forward. The patients, of course, come with different sets of expectations. They come with different histories, not just medical histories, but personal histories. They come with different goals. For some patients, depending on their age, the goal may be that they want to see their child graduate from high school. For some patients, it may be that they want to live out the rest of their life as comfortably as possible, in contradistinction to length of life being the most important thing. And I think certainly as part of the initial sit-down with the patient, one of the things you have to find out is, what does the patient want from you as a physician? What are her most important goals? What toxicities is she afraid of? Just 2 days ago when I was in clinic, I had a patient refuse what I thought was very straightforward and relatively low-intensity chemotherapy because of what had happened to her husband a couple of years before. So I think these are important parts of our interaction with the patient.
Eric, do you actually proactively bring up the issue of the question of curability or lack of curability in the metastatic setting? And how do you see the variation in how patients respond to this and how you respond to them?
I think you have to bring it up because clearly a lot of what we do is set expectations with people so that there are reasonable expectations. Even with that, and even with setting what I think are reasonable expectations, I think if one really stops and questions patients, most of the time their expectations are somewhat different from what ours are. And I'm always struck and humbled by the fact that in someone who I've been taking care of for a long time, where I think it's pretty clear that they're pretty close to the end of their life, that unless there's a very explicit conversation, they're not quite as far along as I think they are in terms of their understanding of where things are. So I think that talking about this from the beginning is important. In truth, it's something I talk about when I talk about adjuvant therapy. I make the point that if breast cancer recurs, it is generally, with the treatment we have available in 2006, incurable. Although I also make the point at that point in time that it's a disease that many women can live with for an extended period of time. Of course, with these two patients, and I know we're not getting into the specifics yet, but I guess I'm a little more hopeful that the second one, who's had a relatively long disease-free interval in spite of the disease in her liver, is going to be around for quite some time.
Joyce, how do you see a patient sort of making this transition from the hope that they've been cured of this disease to the reality of these kinds of metastatic situations?
I think most people do just absolutely remarkably well. I think it's one of those things we all can't know how we would deal with it until we get there, but the patients are fighters, generally speaking, and make that transition to needing continuous therapy for the rest of their lives. Well, I think most women get into the mindset of a day at a time, which is something I really encourage because none of us is clairvoyant and we can quote average statistics, but we can't tell an individual woman what her natural history would be. So I sort of encourage a regimen at a time, a treatment at a time. That's how I personally survive the difficulty of treating metastatic breast cancer. I try not to judge the disease, and I just try to stay in the moment and do the best we can for the woman at that time. And I encourage that outlook. Generally speaking, younger women who are still raising families or whose children are not very well established or who have not had fully mature lives yet, they just want to optimize their longevity. Older women, it's much more important to balance the toxicities of therapy because I think they're just more acutely aware of other comorbidities that they have and want to maintain that functional status. But I think in general, women do absolutely remarkably well with the transition.
Neil, can I make one very quick comment, which is that, so just two nights ago, I was seeing a patient who I'm unbelievably fond of, who's a young woman who has HER2-positive breast cancer, who is just about at the end of the line. And again, someone who I think that she may not be alive more than another few weeks, and she's still thinking many, many, many months. But we were talking about how she was dealing with this, And I said, you can be angry, you can be sad, you can decide to fight this, you can do all sorts of things, but the one thing you can't be is desperate, because desperation won't get you anywhere. And all of her family members are actually desperate, and I said, you got to keep them out of the house if they can't get rid of that. And it is, I think, the one emotion that we all have a difficult time dealing with, it because it's so frustrating, but also it really doesn't help people. And somehow getting beyond that, I think, is often very useful.
Well, let's start to drill down then into the, kind of the algorithms and patterns of how you approach the patient with HER2 negative metastatic disease. And let's begin by focusing on chemotherapy. George, so let's focus on Dennis's patient, who unfortunately doesn't have one of the two targets, either ER or HER2, that we can usually go to. How do you think through the approach to chemotherapy in this situation? And can you talk a little bit about the E2100 study and how that's changed your approach to these kinds of patients?
Sure. Well, the first thing that one looks at in looking at a patient with metastatic breast cancer, of course, is what's their prior therapy. In this patient, if I recollect correctly, this is a patient who's had prior anthracycline-based chemotherapy and has not had taxane-based chemotherapy. And that, of course, is incredibly important. So we would certainly say in this year that taxane-based therapy as a chemotherapy would be a standard of care for this patient. Now, I'll also add another qualifier, which is I'm not always sure that we get steroid receptor values correct, and I'm not always sure that we get HER2 values correct. And so particularly when I've got a patient who's relapsed, I think there's pretty much always a case to be made for getting some more tissue and retesting ER, PR, and HER2. Because a small but fixed percentage of the time, you'll find out that your pathologist didn't quite get it right back in 2000. But let's assume this is a triple negative patient. In my clinic, based on the results of the intergroup trial E2100, we would be likely to recommend to this patient that she receive combination therapy with paclitaxel administered on a weekly basis, as well as bevacizumab given on an every 2-week basis. And this is based on trial E2100, which randomized similar patients to receive either chemotherapy alone or with paclitaxel or to receive chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. And the results of this trial, which were presented in that Annus Mirabilis session at ASCO and then updated by my colleague Kathy Miller at the recent San Antonio meetings, is that you go from a median progression-free survival of about 6 months to a median progression-free survival of about 11 months. And this 5-month improvement in progression-free survival is the largest improvement in progression-free survival in metastatic breast cancer that we've seen in a generation. It is, for instance, a larger absolute improvement than is seen with Herceptin in the setting of Taxol plus minus Herceptin as frontline therapy. So we would certainly consider bevacizumab to play a role here. Now, there's a lot of things we don't know about bevacizumab yet, but one thing we do know, having looked at the forest plots where we've done subset breakdowns, is that triple negative patients appear to get a similar benefit in one analysis that hasn't been presented yet, maybe a little bit more benefit than estrogen receptor positive patients. So we would certainly consider that a standard approach for such patients.
Joyce, can you comment on what has been reported and what you've seen in terms of side effects and toxicity of Avastin in breast cancer? Of course, we have a lot more experience in medical oncology in colon cancers where it was first used. What do we know about the side effects and toxicity in breast cancer and what was seen in that trial?
The E2100 had very few in the way of grade 3-4 toxicities. Maybe a couple of percent of patients had grade 3 hypertension. I don't think there was any grade 4. I don't think there was any serious cardiac toxicity. A few percent of patients had grade 3 or 4 proteinuria. There's certainly some grade 2 hypertension, and George could probably tell us the exact percentage, but very little in the way of serious adverse events in the E2100 trial. George, I don't know what the incidence of grade 2 is. Do you know?
Well, actually, hypertension has a very strange grading system in the CTC criteria. So actually, if you have hypertension that requires a change in therapy, and that's either starting an antihypertensive or adding a new antihypertensive onto an old one, that's grade 3 toxicity. Now, none of us in the room, I think, would normally consider that grade 3 anything. That's the average 52-year-old with a blood pressure of 105 over 92, okay? That actually occurred in about, I think, 14 or 15% of patients. But if you ask, I think, the question Joyce is getting to, which is how many of those women actually suffered as a result of a hypertensive problem, the answer is it's a tiny number. One or two patients had sufficiently severe hypertension that you really would have had to have taken the patient off the drug.
Eric, you did the commentary when Kathy presented the E2100. You followed it up by discussing it. Can you put a little bit more in clinical context what you think this means in terms of patient care, both in terms of the benefit that potentially is offered to the patient as well as to the downside, and what kinds of patients weren't eligible for the study?
So the study was open to women essentially who had HER2 negative disease. There were perhaps a handful of patients with HER2 positive disease who had received Herceptin on a preoperative or adjuvant pilot or some such thing. But essentially, the study was comprised of 2/3 of women who had ER positive breast cancer and 1/3 of women who had ER negative breast cancer who, since they had HER2 negative disease, had triple negative disease like this. Apart from that, the study was actually relatively permissive. Most, but not all, of the patients had not received a taxane like this woman. And of interest, although the group is small, the women who had received a taxane before actually appeared to get every bit as much benefit from bevacizumab as those who hadn't. And of course, they did look for CNS disease because of concerns about bleeding, and so all of the women on the ECOG trial had had negative scans of their brain. I think in terms of this patient, the real issue in terms of how one thinks about her is that there's a sense that she's going to have more difficulty pretty soon. She has, again, so-called triple negative disease. She's had a short disease-free interval. She's not terribly symptomatic, but at the same time, I would expect that she would be even more symptomatic in the short term. And the treatment options for somebody in this situation are relatively limited. So I personally would agree with George, and for this patient, I would think that it's a slam dunk decision that she should get bevacizumab and paclitaxel unless she's eligible for some trial that you want to pursue, that is the standard treatment for this woman.
If she were sicker, if she were in, quote, visceral crisis, where you were concerned that she might not survive if she didn't get a response very quickly, would you consider adding another chemotherapeutic agent or combination chemotherapy plus Avastin?
I'm not sure that I would, because I view this in some way as already combination therapy, and I don't know that adding another chemotherapy drug is going to do that much more. The paradox of that patient who's in visceral crisis and sicker is that while on the one hand one is sometimes tempted to add another drug, and sometimes I do that, that's also the patient where you're even more concerned about adding toxicities from drugs because of the fact that she may get that much sicker as a result of the drugs.
Joyce, what would your likely therapy be for Dr. Lowenthal's patient?
Well, outside of a clinical trial, I would treat her with the weekly paclitaxel and bevacizumab. We happen to have a very interesting clinical trial that I'll mention, which is randomizing patients that are triple negative to irinotecan carboplatin day 1, day 8 versus the same chemotherapy with weekly cetuximab, Erbitux, because about half of the triple negatives have EGFR expression. We don't know if it's really driving the cancer at all. And this is a study, a randomized phase 2, to see if there's any signal that response rates or time to progression will be better in this group with the cetuximab. So I would talk to her about that clinical trial, and then I would be interested in the paclitaxel bevacizumab as second-line therapy for that patient.
Okay, so again, I want to go now to Bill's case and find out how the patient being ER/PR positive might affect your decision. But before I do, just very quickly going down the line, starting with Eric, you've all three said you'd use weekly paclitaxel and bevacizumab. What would your therapy have been a year ago?
It might have been single-agent paclitaxel. It might have been Xeloda. It would have almost certainly been some single-agent chemotherapy, and I actually don't think that the order in which we use these drugs makes a big difference. The reason I'd pick paclitaxel now is because that was the drug that was used in the ECOG trial, and I have no reason not to use paclitaxel in her.
George, a year ago?
I would have used a single-agent taxane, and I think either paclitaxel or docetaxel. Using the paclitaxel on a weekly basis and the docetaxel on an every 3-week basis, either of those?
Joyce?
I tend to use combination therapy early on, and I probably would have given her either paclitaxel or docetaxel and capecitabine in combination. I like a strategy of getting the highest possible response rate trying to consolidate with some radiation therapy for this patient, which I would certainly consider doing, including the mediastinum, and try to get her the highest response possible. Stopping the taxane, keep going indefinitely on the capecitabine is a strategy I use a lot. And you give about 3-4 months of the combined, stop the taxane, keep going.
So you've changed your paradigm pretty significantly then in a year.
Yes, I think the bevacizumab data with that prolonged time to progression is really very intriguing. This patient, unfortunately, is very much at risk for brain metastasis. This is the kind of cancer that is very heavy in terms of the brain. It's going to be intriguing in the E2100 to see if there's any difference ultimately in the development of brain metastasis by inhibiting VEGF. So I don't know the answer to that, but it would be terrific if that were the case.
Okay, now let's shift over to the patient, saying still HER2 negative, but now ERPR positive. Kind of similar situation, what you wouldn't call full-blown visceral crisis, but this is not a lady who's got a couple bone mets, who's minimally symptomatic. She has significant disease in the liver. Eric, how would you likely approach her therapy?
Well, in the end, I would probably treat her the same way as the prior patient, although I think about her a little differently. So with this patient, who, and Bill, my understanding is she's really not symptomatic. You found this from an elevated CEA, correct?
Yeah, she was really minimally to not symptomatic.
Yeah. So she has bulky liver disease. I mean, I thought you were going to say that she had a couple of little lesions in her liver, and she's got a 7-centimeter lesion or a 6.5-centimeter in her lesion and multiple others. So that's enough that it would make me feel a little funny about giving her a hormonal agent, although the truth is, I think she may have hormonally responsive disease. And so she is someone who I would start with some form of chemotherapy. Given the ECOG data, I would probably start with bevacizumab and paclitaxel since it worked equally well in ER-positive disease as best we know. But I'm more optimistic about what's open to her in the future. And if you told me that she had two or three centimeter lesions in her liver and normal liver function tests, I would have been quick to say, hold off on the chemotherapy and use a hormone.
George, how would you approach this woman?
Well, pretty much the same way as Eric. I hear about visceral crisis a lot, and I actually don't see it much in my clinic, I must say. What I mean by visceral crisis would be someone who had a significantly symptomatic lymphangitic lung metastasis might be an example, or a patient who had rapidly progressive liver disease that was symptomatic and perhaps had significant enzyme elevations. In fact, most of our metastatic breast cancer patients, the vast majority, do not fall into the category of visceral metastasis. And I pretty routinely see physicians using the presence of liver metastasis as an excuse to give chemotherapy, whereas if the patient is asymptomatic, has a normal bilirubin, has relatively normal liver enzymes, and as in this patient, is 6 years out from the initial diagnosis of the breast cancer, that means that this tumor took 6 years to get to where it is today. The patient's been off hormonal therapy for a year or more at this point. Bill, is that right?
Yes. Well, she relapsed on Tamoxifen.
So it was still on
4.5 years on.
4.5 years into Tamoxifen.
Okay, so might be a reasonable candidate still for hormonal therapy. I think the devil's in the details, and I think, you know, why medicine is never going to be boiled down to real simple rules is that all of us as physicians, we're in a room with a patient. We get a gestalt about the patient and our comfort level about whether or not the patient needs hormonal therapy or chemotherapy. And this is a patient who I think, as Eric has suggested, is right on the borderline.
Joyce, very briefly, how would you treat this patient?
Well, in this particular biology, ER-positive biology that relapses either in bone or liver or bone-liver, which tends to be the primary site of metastasis for this kind of cancer, I'm extraordinarily impressed with the taxane capecitabine combination. We've done a lot of studies with either docetaxel capecitabine or weekly paclitaxel capecitabine. I have 4 patients in CRs over 3 years out, which I don't have that many other patients with any other chemotherapy or combination, and they all have the same biology, exactly like this patient. So I probably would actually not give this patient bevacizumab because of my own experience with the taxane capecitabine combination. I'd be interested in giving her bevacizumab with her next round of therapy. It's an excellent agent and it looks very promising, but I probably, with this particular biology, I'm extremely impressed with that particular combination, so that's what I would do.
Okay, let's just very briefly follow up and find out what happened to these two women, and then we'll just briefly get some reaction from the faculty and move on to adjuvant Herceptin. Bill? Actually, Bill was in the auditorium.
when this was presented and came back, and I think she was one of the first patients you saw after ASCO?
Yeah, we actually ended up treating her with paclitaxel and bevacizumab, and she started in late May, so this was post-ASCO excitement. And she had a very nice partial response and was treated for about 9 or 10 cycles, very little toxicity, except she started to develop some neuropathy. And last month, after 9 or 10 cycles, her response was plateauing out by CAT scan and by her CA2729, so I decided to stop her treatment now and switch her over to letrozole.
So very common strategy oncologists use, try to induce a response with chemotherapy now with bevacizumab and then going on to maintenance hormones, particularly when somebody having symptoms. We could spend the next 5 hours talking about cost and reimbursement, but we're not going to do that. But just to give you a snapshot of how these kinds of therapies get integrated into practice, can you talk a little bit, Bill, about what happened in terms of reimbursement?
Well, this patient had commercial insurance through the UnitedHealthcare, and they initially approved this patient's treatment, started treatment, paid one claim, then denied claims and said it was off-label. We already, of course, enrolled the patient at the very beginning of the Genentech program they call SPOC, and we fought it with letters and trying to find literature. By the way, right after ASCO, it's hard to find literature when you can't even find the abstract.
There were no abstracts.
Late-breaking abstracts.
It was so late-breaking, there were no abstracts.
The chair of the education committee put this all together in a two-week period.
And we were able to prevail. The patient had to pay a couple cycles, but ultimately the insurance company acquiesced and paid.
You told me you showed them her scans to encourage them.
We sent a letter saying the patient's having this response and so forth, and that's hard for them to turn that down in that setting.
And that ties into what happened with Dennis's patient.
Yeah, just to move ahead. So, yeah, in light of ECOG 2100, we would have liked to have started her on Taxol and bevacizumab, but appeals to her insurance company in our area were repeatedly rejected. And we ultimately started her just on single-agent Taxol weekly, to which she did well at first. There was a diminution in her tumor marker, a diminution in her palpable disease. And this persisted for about the first 6 to 7 weeks, after which things slowly started to pick up again. I restaged her, actually, the day before coming down here to Florida because her markers were going up and her performance level was slipping. And a PET scan and a CAT scan now showed that her disease was really taking quite a leap. And her mediastinal nodal disease was now very extensive. Her chest wall lesion had doubled in size. And she now had extensive bone metastasis, which she did not have at the start of treatment. And so the question is where to go now.
Can you just say what you did?
I'll tell you what I did. The tempo of her disease was such that we bit the bullet. I switched her to Taxotere, capecitabine, and Avastin.
Quick comment, Joyce, about both cases.
I generally find that in patients whose disease has recurred on an anthracycline and who are relatively taxane resistant, she didn't do so great, that I don't find capecitabine works as well in that setting as it does in some others. So I probably would have treated her with a platinum-based regimen. Etoposide cisplatin is what I usually do in these triple negatives that I think are refractory to anthracyclines and taxanes. I think I would definitely have been wanting to add the bevacizumab, though. I think that's something that I definitely would be interested, particularly this biology being so highly proliferative. I'd be very interested in that and would certainly have done that as well. So I just found I love capecitabine, but I don't find it works terrifically well in anthracycline and taxane type refractory. You could argue she's not terribly anthracycline refractory. She did have a disease-free interval of 3 years, but she's not particularly taxane sensitive. So I probably would have gone to a platinum-based regimen with her.
George, any comment about the two cases?
I probably would have used capecitabine. I actually haven't seen a real data breakdown on capecitabine by triple negative versus HER2 positive versus ER positive. The reality is that this is a patient who's getting third-line therapy for metastatic breast cancer. And if you ask, is she going to do really well with anything at this point, the answer is no, that virtually everything is going to give her a response rate that's probably 25% or lower.
What about bevacizumab?
Well, the only data set that we have for anthracycline taxane refractory metastatic breast cancer is a randomized trial of capecitabine plus minus bevacizumab. And while the addition of bevacizumab to capecitabine in that setting significantly improved the response rate by about 10-12% with independent reviewers, it did not improve either progression-free survival or overall survival. And Again, I guess this gets back to why do we treat metastatic breast cancer? We've all got our hierarchy of goals for patients with metastatic breast cancer, which is why it's important to sit down with the patient. My hierarchy includes improving survival and maintaining quality of life as perhaps my number one and number two goals, and I put improving response rate by 10% pretty far down on the list, to tell the truth.
So in this situation, you use capecitabine. Anything else?
No, I'd typically use it as a single agent.
Eric, what would you do in this situation?
So I would do one of two things. I would either give her capecitabine, as George suggested, or I'm going to guess that she was involved in all of these complex issues surrounding getting the bevacizumab paid for, and that at this point she's going to feel a little funny not getting it, and you're going to feel funny not giving it to her. With that part of this, I actually would probably treat her with vinorelbine and bevacizumab. Hal Burstein in our institution did a 55-patient phase 2 trial of vinorelbine and bevacizumab that was presented at San Antonio a couple of years ago with a response rate of about 30% in the first and second line setting. It's a regimen that clearly has activity and has a defined toxicity profile. And I share George's concerns about how much bevacizumab is going to add here. But I think you may be in a situation where, to some extent, you need to use it for a lot of complicated reasons.
Let's move on to adjuvant Herceptin. I'll ask Bill to present very briefly his patient.
This is a 33-year-old white female who I just saw last month, who noted a right breast mass, underwent a right lumpectomy and axillary node dissection on January 6, and pathologically she had a 1.7 centimeter grade 3 infiltrating ductal carcinoma. All 11 lymph nodes were negative, estrogen receptor 99%, progesterone receptor 85%, HER2 new positive by FISH with a ratio of 9.27.
And can you talk a little bit more about the woman, what her lifestyle was like, and what her reaction was to this situation?
She was pretty calm about things, especially for a younger woman. She had one child, age 13, and she actually had a partner and came to the office that way and plans no more children.
Okay, so that one's kind of out on the table. We picked a couple node-negative cases. We want to talk about node-positive disease, but certainly right now the biggest controversy, at least in terms of whether to use trastuzumab, is in the node-negative population, and we'll talk about some other issues in terms of testing. Atif, can you present your patient?
Yes. My patient is a 44-year-old woman who was found to have a 1 centimeter mass in the left breast on a mammogram. Biopsy showed invasive ductal carcinoma. She underwent a left lumpectomy and a sentinel lymph node biopsy. The sentinel lymph node biopsy revealed 2 nodes negative for carcinoma, both by H&E staining as well as immunohistochemical stains for cytokeratin. The lumpectomy revealed negative margins and a 0.8, 8 millimeter, moderately differentiated invasive ductal carcinoma, no in situ component, ERPR positive, and HER2-new 3+ by immunohistochemistry and 4.2 by FISH testing.
One thing, I want to get back to George's point earlier in terms of now that we have these markers, are we sure that the assays that we have are really accurately assessing them? How do we look at these two patients in terms of their HER2 assessment, George, and what do we know about false negatives, false positive, IHC, and FISH with HER2?
If we look at the two standard ways of looking, I might add that there are more than two, but if we look at immunohistochemistry, which is, of course, a protein-based assay, and fluorescence in situ hybridization, which is actually measuring gene copy, we actually have a pretty fair amount of data at this point. I think it's safe to say that immunohistochemistry represents an art form, and that is to say that when we ask the pathologist to look under the microscope and say, is something 0, 1+, 2+, or 3+, and there's certainly variability among pathologists, there's variability with the same pathologist from day to day, and it's reasonably likely that probably about 15% of the time, 20% of the time, the average pathologist just gets it wrong. Now, there's also problems that can be related to fixation, which antibody you use, et cetera. But even in good hands, there's a fair amount of interpathologist and intrapathologist variability. Now, fluorescence in situ hybridization, in theory, should overcome those problems. And that is to say that when you do FISH testing, you have an internal control in the form of chromosome 17 centromere marker. So you should be able to count the number of centromeres and count the number of HER2 in the cell and should be able to get a ratio that should be absolutely perfect. Now, of course, in the real world, nothing is perfect. And indeed, there is now some emerging data that suggests that because fluorescence in situ hybridization is fluorescent, that's to say that it has to be done fairly quickly, and because pathologists are not all equally well trained, there is, in fact, false positives and false negatives for fish as well, which is difficult for all of us. I think that's going to get better over time. Today in my hospital, we tend to use fish pretty much exclusively. I would not criticize someone who, for instance, if they had a 2-plus by immunohistochemistry, did fish on that patient and ignored fish on a 3-plus patient. I think the tougher area actually are those patients who are 0 and 1-plus, because we know from a fair number of studies that some of those patients, in fact, are fish positive as well. I think 3% and 7% respectively in the largest database that I've seen. Do you want to ignore 7% of 1-pluses when their life might be saved by HER2 testing with fish? I don't know the answer to that. Part of that is cost-benefit analysis. Part of it is availability in your own hospital. But in my hospital, we typically would use fish.
Eric, we've known about the issue of false negative and false positive ER for a while, and I have, and lots of people have been furious about it, thinking about a therapy reduced recurrence rate by 50%. Now we have another targeted therapy that reduces recurrence by 50%. What can a physician in practice do to assure that they're getting an accurate HER2 test?
I think that the first thing that one can do is, if there's any question in your mind about the validity of the test, either because you simply don't trust the people doing the test or because it's discordant with the clinical data you have. So by that I mean the 55-year-old woman with an ER/PR-positive lobular cancer that comes back HER2 3+. You know that lobular cancers are almost negative, not never, but almost negative HER2 positive. So in situations like that, or in situations where you just don't trust the people doing it, you have to ask for it to be repeated. And back to George's comment earlier about managing people in the metastatic setting, I mean, I think one of the reasons why more and more we're going back to doing biopsies in the metastatic setting, and sometimes doing repeated biopsies in the metastatic setting, is to make sure we know what's going on with the tumor. I actually think with HER2 that most of the time there is very little change from primary to the metastatic setting, and even when there are reported changes, that much of that may all be testing error.
Joyce, can you talk a little bit about how you think through the situation, the patient with a node-negative tumor, and whether or not to utilize trastuzumab, as in these situations, particularly this one lady who has a 0.8 centimeter tumor?
It's the Vices test by ratio, 4.2 compared to the centromere. Is that right? Yeah. So it's a real fish positive. We don't have good data sets to tell us how effective hormonal therapy alone, for example, tamoxifen in this premenopausal woman would be. I don't feel comfortable using our overview analysis where all comers, we can show a 40% or 50% reduction in relapse risk with tamoxifen, for example. I don't know what those data are in HER2-positive breast cancer. So I think it would be less. I think HER2-driven breast cancer is hormonally less sensitive. Same with chemotherapy. I don't know a good data set that I can tell the woman your benefits from chemotherapy are X with HER2-driven breast cancer. So I, generally speaking, multiply the risk by 1.5 in my head. So if a 8-millimeter grade 2 cancer, taking the HER2 out of the equation, has about a 10% risk of systemic relapse, I usually multiply that by 1.5 relative risk in my head. And so I'm starting at about 15% risk of relapse as far as I can possibly estimate it. And then I just really don't know exactly what hormonal therapy and chemotherapy alone will get this patient. So I tend to look at the data and say that there's not a lot of difference between an 8-millimeter cancer and a 10-millimeter cancer that were allowed, for example, on the BCIRG trial or in the HERA trial. So then I try to use the inhibitors that are driving the cancer and then try to minimize the risk.
George, speaking about risk, of course, the obvious issue here is cardiac safety. Again, we've got younger women in good health What would you say to a 33 or a 44-year-old woman, putting it in a patient perspective, about what the risk is in terms of cardiac dysfunction or actually cardiac symptoms and consequences?
Well, if you look at the two large North American trials where we gave Adriamycin and Cytoxan followed by Paclitaxel and Herceptin, overall the congestive heart failure rates for patients in those trials are somewhere in the 3 to 4% range. The question that comes up is, do we know who those 3 to 4% of women are, and can we use that information to guide our therapy? The answer I'd have to say today is we're not really sure. The NSABP database suggested that the women who were most likely to develop congestive heart failure were those who were old, defined, I hate to say, as over the age of 50, which I...
It's okay, George.
Which I must say was the most depressing thing I've heard at ASCO in many years. I mean, it was like sitting through a pancreatic cancer lecture.
Hey, that's getting better.
And patients who have the lowest level of ejection fractions that were allowed for going into the trial, that's to say the 50 to 55% range. In the NSABP experience, if you met those two criteria, you had roughly one chance in five of having a cardiac event. So that's pretty significant. Now, I hasten to add that in 9831, an identical analysis was done by the NCCTG, and they did not come up with the same pattern. And, of course, when you do retrospective subset analyses on small subgroups in evolving trials, you can get very different results. I don't think it's particularly surprising that older people would have more heart dysfunction. So I think what you're left with today is you walk into a room and you say you've got a 3 to 4% chance of getting congestive heart failure. There is a reasonable likelihood that if you get it, it will improve, but probably not all will improve. And those that improve may need to be on chronic CHF-type medication, perhaps for the rest of their life, for all we know. So that's very definitely part of the trade-off, particularly for a patient with an 8-millimeter tumor that I think becomes very pertinent.
And the patient says, I was out on the internet and I saw that at San Antonio, Dr. Slayman presented TCH. What about the risk of that in terms of cardiac toxicity?
Well, there, of course, we run into a different issue, which is CTH as good as AC followed by TH? Now, the answer today is that in the one trial that we have, both regimens are better than not getting a Herceptin-containing regimen, and the regimens are not statistically significantly different from each other with very early follow-up. Now, having said that, the trend in that trial certainly favors ACTH over CTH. So I personally tend to use CTH in patients where I have significant concerns about cardiac toxicity.
And I'm going to call it TCH, but anyhow, what
would
you say?
Sorry.
All right, CTH. What would you say to the patient about the risk of cardiac toxicity with CTH?
Well, it would be pretty trivial. I believe the numbers were just literally one or two patients, a very tiny number of patients who developed congestive heart failure in that arm of the trial.
Eric, how do you follow patients in terms of cardiac monitoring, and what do you do if you start to see some changes?
I do have to point out to George that Joyce and I are both 49, so we're not quite there yet. But
time wounds all heal.
Maybe I wasn't supposed to advertise Joyce's age in public, but I can advertise mine.
Cardiac monitoring.
In terms of cardiac monitoring, I would in fact use the cardiac monitoring that was used in the studies.
Which is?
Which is a baseline ejection fraction. If I were to give AC followed by paclitaxel and Herceptin, I would get another EF after the AC, and then essentially every 3 months during the paclitaxel therapy. The one thing I can say, though, is that I would be a little bit more flexible than the study rules, because the study was put together at a time when we didn't know if trastuzumab would work or not in the adjuvant setting. We now know it does. So, for example, someone whose EF fell from 55 to 49% with AC, I wouldn't automatically say that that woman were never going to receive a drop of trastuzumab. I would either give it and look again soon or repeat it in a month.
Getting back to the monitoring, what about after the taxane's done?
After the taxane's done and she's still receiving Herceptin, I would continue to do it every 3 months.
And when would you stop?
I'd stop it at the end of treatment.
And that's it?
And that's it, unless she had symptoms.
Okay.
I would not feel a need to continue on beyond the end of treatment in the absence of symptoms.
MUGA or ECHO?
At our institution, we tend to do a MUGA.
Okay, very briefly, can we follow up with what happened to these two patients first, Bill?
I went ahead and started her on Adriamycin and Cytoxan with the plans to treat her just like the intergroup study, N9831, with Herceptin and taxanes concomitantly.
And that's where she is right now?
Well, she just started, so she's not even had her second cycle of AC yet.
I'm sorry, this is the 33-year-old?
Yes.
Okay, and can you follow up, Atif?
Yes, my patient actually, she qualified for the Breast Cancer International Research Group 006 based on grade, because it allowed no negative patients, and she randomized to receive taxotere carboherceptin. She received 6 cycles and a whole year of Herceptin. She did well. Her ejection fraction dropped 7-8 points. We stopped Herceptin for a few weeks, and then we resumed it. She's now 6 months after finishing the study, and her ejection fraction is back to baseline.
How did she tolerate it, and how do you find people tolerating the TCH versus the AC taxane H?
In this patient, actually, it was shocking to her. She came to see me whether she needs chemotherapy or not. And nobody talked to her about the taxane. She's 0.8 centimeter, whether she needed just FEC or nothing. Then here am I talking to her about a taxane and a year of Herceptin. Therefore, the first meeting was not a very pleasant one. But subsequently, for whatever reason, she trusted what I was telling her. She did very well. She had a lot of emotional issues that she had to come every 3 weeks. She's an architect. She continued to work full time. The carboplatin taxotere caused her moderate degree of fatigue, although her hemoglobin was normal, but we got her through the treatment.
Eric, in my clinic, the second patient would never get trastuzumab today, and that's not a negotiation. That would happen in somebody else's office, because I would not give adjuvant trastuzumab to a woman with an 8-millimeter ERPR-positive node-negative cancer outside of some sort of trial, ideally a trial that gave less chemotherapy, not more. The second patient, while not eligible for any of the U.S. trials, I would be comfortable with.
How about 1.0?
I think that I actually, I disagree a little bit with Joyce. I actually do think we know the benefits of anthracycline-based chemotherapy in patients with HER2-positive disease, and I think we have reason to believe it's as great as in patients with HER2-negative disease, if not greater. And there's also pretty clearly some benefit associated with hormonal therapy. In Richard Love's paper from the patient population in Southeast Asia, women who had HER2-positive breast cancer and received or underwent an oophorectomy and tamoxifen had every bit as much benefit as those women who did not have HER2-positive disease.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Breast Cancer Update.